Well, thanks very much. Thanks for the invitation to come here. So I thought we've had quite a lot of mathematics already today. I'm here to share with you a vision. It's an apocalyptic vision. But now my concern is with pairing-based cryptography, that it's a very large area. It's growing very fast. There's a lot of people working on pairings. There's something called the Pairing-Based Crypto Lounge, which is run by Paolo Barreto. And here's some quotes from the website. He tries to give an overview of pairing-based cryptography, but it hasn't been maintained for over 2 years. So 2 years ago, there were already 200 papers. And then there's this apology. I apologize to researchers that it contributed to the site for the delay in updating references. The volume of research papers has increased exponentially, underlining this exponentially. There's exponential growth in pairing-based cryptography. That's what Paolo Barreto says. So it's impossible to even keep a website surveying this up to date. The PKC conference, the submissions have just been in. 22% of the submissions to PKC this year were on pairing-based cryptography. This is clearly unsustainable. Pairing-based cryptography is an inconvenient truth. Now, having shared this vision of the apocalypse, it's not too late to save us. And I want you to join me on my crusade and to solve this challenge, to kill pairing-based cryptography. So that's what I want to talk about. I want to talk about killing off pairing-based cryptography completely. And some of you might be feeling a bit nervous because you like elliptic curves. And I just want to stress at this point that killing pairing-based cryptography does not necessarily kill elliptic curve cryptography, because pairing-based cryptography is only about some very special elliptic curves. So the rest of elliptic curve cryptography we can still have faith in, but some other types of cryptography may also die if we kill pairings. So seriously, here's the plan of the talk. My introduction to pairings is going to be even briefer than the others. And I want to talk really about something very close to what Florian was talking about. And then I want to talk about this potential multivariate attack on the pairing inversion problem. And then if there's time, I'll talk about some other computational problems and challenges as well. And there probably won't be time to talk about this last item. So I'm going to stick more to the supersingular case because the multivariate attack is going to really work in the supersingular case. So I'm going to be thinking of, this is the type 1 case. I've got an elliptic curve over some ground field FQ, and I've called it R, the large prime point order. And I'm really considering, I imagine I've got a distortion map, here it is, and I'm really pairing points defined over the ground field. And mu R is the Rth roots of unity in some extension, where K is the embedding degree. And this is the tape pairing that we've seen already, pairing of P and Q. I've got the Miller function, I've got a distortion map, which is an endomorphism, which extends the field of definition. And so I'm computing this Miller function at this point, and I've got some final exponentiation, which I'm going to be talking a lot about, final exponentiations. And that's the tape pairing, and we've seen this in Florian's talk. This is why we swapped talks, because I didn't want to define all this stuff. And there's this recent work that sort of makes these things more efficient by considering, rather than computing the Miller function where n is some multiple of the order of the point, you can sort of by magic take these other quantities. So this really started with Dersmer and Lee, and then there was this eta pairing stuff, and then there's this more general eta pairing stuff, and it's all very nice. And the whole point is you can get this loop shortening that Florian was talking about. So you can end up using a value n which is less than you think it would be. So that's good. And something that Florian didn't talk about, but you can sort of simplify the final exponentiation as well by some tricks. And all these things make pairings faster, and so there's a very fast pairing computations now. So that's sort of the background. And now I want to talk, this talk's really about computational problems, so I want to talk about some of these computational problems. So I'm kind of assuming everyone knows the discrete log problem and the Diffie-Hellman problem. So I guess in case you don't by now, Cliffy Hellman has given. Can people see this? Yeah, I guess they can. Given P, AP, BP to compute ABP. So you've got the discrete log problem, the Diffie-Hellman problem, and the elliptic curve group, and these are well studied. You've got the discrete log problem and the Diffie-Hellman problem in the subgroup of the finite field, which may be represented as a torus or something, and that's reasonably well studied. But much more new that's come to pairing-based cryptography is this bilinear Diffie-Hellman problem. So this is a generalization of the Diffie-Hellman problem that makes sense with pairings. So we're given a point P, AP, BP, and CP, and the goal is to compute. So just to stress again, I'm always considering I've got distortion maps. So this is, my pairing is not alternating. So this is some field elements to the power ABC. So this is the computational problem, which is the most important for pairing-based cryptography. The cryptosystems ultimately depend on this. Certainly, the Bonnet-Franklin identity-based encryption scheme depends on this problem. And I'm going to talk about a bunch more computational problems that depend. That arise out of pairing-based crypto. And I'm going to use this notation, A implies B, so that if these are computational problems, if A is hard, then B must also be hard. Or if you like, A is an easier problem than B. This is going to be the same as having a Turing reduction from solving A to solving B. So you're saying that A is an easier problem than B. So if you can solve the Diffie-Hellman problem in the elliptic curve, you can solve bilinear Diffie-Hellman. Or if you can solve the Diffie-Hellman problem in the finite field, you can solve the bilinear Diffie-Hellman problem. So for the bilinear Diffie-Hellman to be hard, it must be true that both these problems be hard. So that's just what I'm saying there. That's all kind of standard stuff. And the thing I really want to talk about today is this pairing inversion problem, which is not quite the same way Florian wrote it, but anyway. And the abbreviation FTI, this was used by Antoine Joux in a survey paper, fixed tape inversion. So I'm going to use his acronym, even though I'm not using his name for it. So the idea is you've got your pairing, and you fix a point P on the elliptic curve, and you've got some target pairing value Z, and the idea is you want to somehow invert, so you're trying to find Q so that the pairing value gives Z. So Florian's sort of two-sided, but I'm fixing my P, and
he's not the one who proposed it.
For pairing inversion, does he? Okay, that may be true. This is a computational problem. Given P, given Z, find Q so that the pairing value of P and Q gives me Z or Z. Just a quick reduction. If you can solve discrete logs in the finite field, you can solve the pairing inversion problem. It's easy. You just choose a random point, compute the pairing, solve a discrete log in the finite field, and then that gives you the pre-image. It's kind of an obvious thing. So this pairing inversion problem is not any harder than solving discrete logs in the finite field. So my notation is to write it this way. So it could be easy. It might be easy. I don't know. We get this slight non sequitur, which I nearly changed. So at this point, all we know is this pairing inversion problem. It's not harder than discrete logs in the finite field. It might be easy. So we're going to think about how we might solve it. And one note I want to make is this final exponentiation seems to make this a harder problem to solve. The problem is that if you think about how you compute pairings, you compute some Miller algorithm, and then you perform some exponentiation. And this final exponentiation is kind of annoying because lots of different possible outputs of Miller's algorithm end up going to the same thing. So if you're going to somehow try and algebraically reverse Miller's algorithm, it's really annoying that there's some operation has kind of destroyed information by several possible outputs of the algorithm actually give you the same pairing value. So that's why later on I'm going to be talking about final exponentiations a lot. Okay, that slide's in the wrong place. Anyway, so going back to Verhoeve, which was mentioned before, what Florian mentioned, he gave this very nice result that said if you can invert pairing, so if you can get a map from the finite field back to the elliptic curve, then you can solve computational Diffie-Hellman in the finite field, and you can solve computational Diffie-Hellman in the elliptic curve. So this is the theorem that Florian mentioned as well. And it's a very nice result. And this is quite funny, because this was all about XTR. This theorem is kind of this is a political battle between XTR and ECC, but you don't need to know about that. It's just a nice theorem on its own. And so we end up with this kind of problem hierarchy. We end up that this pairing inversion problem can't be harder than discrete log in a finite field, but it should be harder than Diffie-Hellman in the elliptic curve, and it should be harder than Diffie-Hellman in the finite field as well. And this is what Florian was saying. You might get a kind of separation between these two problems. But, I mean, really, there's this kind of idea of Maurer and the equivalence between Diffie-Hellman and a discrete log, sort of Maurer, Maurer-Wolf, Denboer kind of reduction. So you should really believe that discrete log and finite fields and Diffie-Hellman and finite fields are equivalent. So so these problems should really be the same. So the pairing inversion problem should be as hard as finite fields and discrete logs. So if you believe that finite fields and discrete log is hard, then you should believe that pairing inversion is hard. If you believe the Maurer separation of these things. So if you want to kill pairing-based cryptography like I do, then you're also trying to kill finite field cryptography as well. It's only been studied for thousands of years, if you believe the hype. Just fiddle with my microphone for a while. I don't know if this can be any better. Okay, and Takazu has, here he is, has studied this problem as well, this pairing inversion problem, and I hope that this statement is more or less accurate. He considers a polynomial representation of a homomorphism from the finite field back to the elliptic curve, and he shows that the degree has to be more or less maximal and the coefficients more or less have to be all non-zero. So this is giving... I mean, what it's fair to say, there's overwhelming evidence that pairing inversion should be a hard problem. So you'd have to be pretty crazy to try and work on pairing inversion as a computational problem. But anyway, in the face of lots of evidence in the contrary, I want to look at pairing inversion. So why would someone be crazy enough to look at this? The idea is we've been doing all this work on efficient implementation of pairings, and the pairing algorithms have sort of got simpler and simpler and faster, and it's really nice. You can compute pairings quickly, but at a certain point you start to think, hang on, this is almost getting too easy. I mean, pairing computation is, this eta and eta stuff sort of makes, in some sense, the pairing independent of the order of the point. It's kind of very strange. So it's natural to come back to these questions and just check whether there's any, whether there's something funny going on. So what I really want to talk about just now is some joint work with Colm O'Hagerty and Caroline Sheedy, which was about getting rid of the final exponentiation. So like I said, the final exponentiation somehow makes it harder to invert pairing. So if we can get rid of this final exponentiation, there's more of a chance we can reverse Miller's algorithm. Similar stuff was done by all these people, many of whom are in the room. Sort of similar kind of idea that you can get rid of the final exponentiation. And I'm going to show you how this leads to a multivariate attack. So I'm just going to do this for a fixed example. The theory is more general, but we're just going to study this one elliptic curve, y squared plus y equals x cubed plus ax plus 0 or 1, and in characteristic 2. And this is a supersingular curve, and it has embedding degree 4. And there's a distortion map, which I'm not going to write down, but it maps points over the small field to points over a degree 4 extension. And that's the usual lines and things. And what it all boils down to is eta pairing, which is very closely related to the eta pairing. To compute the pairing of P and Q, you end up just computing this product. And this is the sort of the long one, not the truncated one. So you end up computing this product where you're taking the line, tangent line through 2 to the I times P and evaluating it psi Q, and you're dividing by the vertical line through 2 to the I plus 1 times P, and then you're exponentiating to some power, And I mean, this is actually computing. This is computing the Miller function of 2 to the m p. That's what this product's doing, is computing this function. So that's what the eta pairing is defined to be, and then you should normally do some kind of final exponentiation, because you normally have to do a final exponentiation to get rid of redundancies, but I'm going to show we can avoid that. So that's what we're going to be studying. So I want to explain, or sketch, why we don't need to do an exponentiation here. I mean, so you normally would raise to the power of, well, normally you'd raise to the power 2 to the 2m minus 1. It can be, the exponentiation can be simplified to that form. So I'm just going to, this is conjugation in the quadratic extension. So there's this kind of more or less straightforward lemma. If the lines are, this is sort of a general fact. If the choice of your lines is normalized, so the leading coefficients are right. Now, how much do I say about proof? I just want to say that if you evaluate the line at psi q, and then you evaluate the line at psi q, and this is a norm. You're basically taking a product of this with its Galois conjugate. You get the same thing as evaluating the vertical line at psi q, squaring it, and then multiplying by the vertical line. 2 times p and psi q, this is just sort of a fact. And it follows from the fact that you conjugate the distortion map. This point maps into the trace of your subgroup, so you conjugate it, you get a negative. And you're basically multiplying L of LP of X of a point with LP of minus a point, and you just look at the divisors, and you see that this statement should be true up to divisors. So the divisor of this function should be the same as the divisor of this function. And then if you've normalized the leading coefficients right, these things just turn out to be equal. It's kind of not deep or anything. So what's that all about? Going back to this product again. So if you multiply this product by the same thing with bars over it everywhere, you end up with an L times an L bar on the top, and V bar is the same as V because it depends only on X. And you end up with this fact that if Z is the value of the function without the final exponentiation, then Z has norm 1. And yeah, you just apply the lemma and a whole bunch of things just simplify, and then you notice that this is a product where sort of everything cancels out, and you're just left with this product cancels out to be this over that, and then you show that those two things are equal, and it's very easy to show these things. So you end up with Z being norm 1. It's interesting. And then the final corollary is that you don't need to do any final exponentiation. And why is this? You let Z be the value output by that loop. We've shown it's got norm 1. That means it's got order dividing 2 to the 2m plus 1. And you should be computing the Z value to the power of 2 to the 2m minus 1, but you just do obvious algebra here. Shows this is the same as computing Z to the minus 2. And you're in characteristic 2, so squaring is bijection, and so you might as well not bother doing it. It's not collapsing values like the final exponentiation usually does. It's a one-to-one map. So there's no need to do this final exponentiation. If you've normalized all the functions correctly, you can get it right the first time. So you can run Miller's algorithm, and whatever the value that comes out, that will do. That's a bilinear pairing. So I'm sorry that's kind of half a sketch of a proof or something, but anyway, if people are really concerned, I've got a preprint on this stuff. I mean, any questions or anything? Okay. Oh, yeah, and just to... Oh, there's another detail that I guess I should... let me just go back. When you compute these things in practice, this is not what you do. You don't compute a product of a line over another line and then raise everything to the power of some power of 2. What you do is you sort of bring... I mean, this is some kind of Frobenius action. So you bring this into the equations of everything. So what you end up doing is you're computing a product of lines, and some other equation of the line is being conjugated by Frobenius as you go along. So to give the actual pseudocode, so your program to compute pairings now looks like this, and there's this weird sort of square roots going on, and that's because of this Galois action coming into these equations of the lines. So basically, you've got a numerator value and a denominator value that start off being 1. You initialize some stuff. You loop around m times. That's probably a 0. I'm guessing that's a 0, not a 1. It should be a loop of m steps. And you just compute some stuff. And this is the vertical line. The denominator is the previous denominator times some value of some vertical line. You some filling around. The numerator is the previous numerator times some line equation. And then you square and you output the quotient of these two things. And there's no exponentiation that's required. And this will give you a bilinear pairing. And I'm going to be talking about pairing inversion, so I'm going to be thinking about how do I reverse this algorithm if I know p, and I know my z value that comes out, and I don't know the point q. And if you look, I've got horrible square roots and things going on with the p's, because p is the fixed numbers. I know how to do that. And what's happening with the q's? I've just got some kind of linear polynomials in the q's and a squaring. So it's not inconceivable that you could somehow reverse this algorithm. Okay. Unfortunately, we can't do the truncated eta pairing, so this is the one with a short loop, a loop that depends on t rather than q, or the eta pairing. It doesn't work. The proof doesn't come out right. But I've said, it doesn't just work for this elliptic curve. It works for all sorts of other hyperelliptic curves as well. So what I'm saying is you can compute pairings without an exponentiation, final exponentiation, on all sorts of supersingular curves. Okay, so here's this pairing inversion using a multivariate method to solve pairing inversion. So we've got a fixed point P, a pairing value Z, and we want to solve for Q, and our algorithm is computing Z as just some product of some lines evaluated at Q. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to write Q. So Q should be a point on an elliptic curve over F2 to the M. So I just do the obvious thing. I mean, I don't know what Q is. So let's write it as a bunch of unknown bits times some polynomial basis for the finite field or something. So the XIs are just unknown elements of F2. YQ, again, we just write as some sort of unknown bits times some representation. So I'm going to try and work out these elements of F2. And in that algorithm, I had some XQ goes to XQ squared. I had some kind of squaring operation going on. But I'm in characteristic 2. That's just applying some linear transformation. So I can get the representation from XQ squared, again, as some linear expression in my unknowns, XI. So the squaring step in my algorithm is still a linear operation. So I'm computing Z as a product of the lines, and all these lines ultimately just become linear polynomials. They're really our lines. They're linear polynomials in my unknowns. So I just bring the denominator over and put everything together, so I get polynomials. And this is some huge polynomial over F2 to the 4m, which should be 0, and I quite coefficients, and I get 4m polynomials over F2, and I should try and solve the system of polynomials. I mean, that's what you do, right? And you can make it easy for yourself. You can put in your field equations. We're working over F2, so everything should satisfy this being 0, or equivalently, you just make sure you never have any variable appearing to a power of more than just 1. And I can get more equations by remembering that my point should lie on an elliptic curve. So I get a massively overdetermined system of equations, which is good. That's what we like for determined systems. We know there's a solution. And so you go in, you ask Magma to solve this thing for you, and you wait. And So here's an attack. I've said this is an attack. I've given you an algorithm to solve the pairing inversion problem, but algorithms may not be efficient. So the ideal the polynomials we're trying to solve require storage proportional to, so p equals 2 in my example, storage proportional to 2 to the 2m. And I mean, your group's already set up, so 2 to the m is m is 160. So you know, you can't actually write down this ideal. But I did even implement this algorithm, and you know, it does work for like m equals 5 and m equals 7 and things. Okay, if you do it naively.
So you have an underlying representation
for the polynomials. Well, the polynomials, maybe the better way to say it, the polynomials. Any one of those polynomials in this thing. Any one of these polynomials has 2 to the 2m non-zero coefficient. Well, I mean, 2 to the 2m monomials. Yes, correct. Yes, correct. Well, in fact, it is, right? Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. I mean, this ideal has a representation. I mean, the variety will have one point in it. And so the ideal is, in fact, x0 minus 1. Yeah, yeah. So you're right. The statement is completely false. Yeah. Because I know for a fact it has a better representation. Yeah, okay. So I should say that the size of these polynomials is 2 to the 2m. So the guy asked me if I wanted to, the organizer asked me if I wanted to give him my slides, and I said, I'll wait till after my talk in case anyone finds any mistakes. So that was the right thing to say. Anyway, I mean, okay, so the input to my Grobner-Bessels algorithm has exponential size at the moment. And so the multivariate attack seems to be infeasible for elliptic curves. Yeah, well, never mind. What about high-genus curves? So just looking at the Dersimer-Lee curves, which everything works for. So these are curves. This is y squared equals x to the p minus x plus or minus 1. And the genus is p minus 1 over 2. So as p increases, genus increases, the extension you need to take, fp to the m, gets smaller because your group's getting bigger. So the m's are getting smaller and smaller and smaller, nice and small here. And then these polynomials start to get better size. So this is like, you know, it starts off 2 to the 100, that's no good, but you're getting down to sort of 2 to the 28. And, you know, it's conceivable that you could actually start to manipulate these things. Sorry? That, exactly, that's why I put it on my slide. Yeah, this is a feasible, this is a potential. I mean, I'm not saying you can solve a Grobner basis, but I'm saying at least you can represent the ideal. Yeah, that's the point. I mean, this could get easy. So this algorithm may, in fact, be effective on high genus curves. I mean, as Florian was saying, if you take somehow the limiting case, then it, you know, it's really... Anyway, I think if you take the limiting case, you'd probably do a different method. But, I mean, the problem is we have a sub-exponential algorithm for discrete logs already in as the genus grows as well. So it's unclear what this means for pairing-based cryptography, but in some sense, since this thing's connected to finite field discrete logs, this really might tell you that some finite field discrete logs are somehow, I don't know, finite field Diffie-Hellman problems are easier than they should be or something. So there's really, I think this is interesting. What am I meant to finish? Quarter past or something, is it? 20 past? No. Yeah, okay, that's good. So, what about some other computational problems? What about pairing inversion where I'm free to choose both of the points? So I've just given a target value z, and I'm free to come up with both p and q, so that the pairing of p and q is z. This is no longer going to have a unique solution because I'm going to have all sorts of possibilities. I have no idea how to tackle this problem. The kind of thing I've been talking about is not easily... The method I'm proposing, this would be definitely not the right thing to do because you'd somehow double your number of variables and it would get more and more complicated. But it seems this ought to be an easier problem. I've got no idea how to solve this problem, so there's something for everyone to think about. Who's joining my crusade, they can think about this over the week. Okay, and I want to tell you about some other computational problems. So we had bilinear Diffie-Hellman, that's the one I talked about before. I think I'm more or less... put up this diagram already. But you know, I've been spending my time thinking about this kind of thing, but I mean, bilinear Diffie-Hellman should be much easier. But I've got absolutely no idea how to even start thinking about how to break the bilinear Diffie-Hellman problem. But any ideas, anyone who has any suggestions on how you might go about attacking that, I'd be interested to talk with them about it. An even easier one, the decision bilinear Diffie-Hellman problem. Given P, AP, BP, CP, and some potential field element Z, is Z the output to the bilinear Diffie-Hellman problem? Absolutely no idea how to start thinking about this problem. It's, you can show that it's, well, obviously it's got to be easier than bilinear Diffie-Hellman, but you can show it's also got to be easier than decision Diffie-Hellman and finite field. Like I said, I've got absolutely no idea how to start on this, so any ideas would be very welcome. And then, oh, there's loads of them. Look at all this. I didn't even know what these ones... the first one's strong Diffie-Hellman, I think. K-strong Diffie-Hellman, so this is an extension of Diffie-Hellman. You've got K-Diffie-Hellman inversion, so given these K-tuples, you've got to compute X inverse P. You've got these weird ones where you're computing pairs. You're given this input, so somehow there's all this information about X, and then the output is meant to be a value H, so you know, modulo the order of the point, and H plus X inverse multiple of P. I've got no idea whether this is a hard problem or easy. I mean, it's pretty weird. This one is like the previous one, but you're given a whole bunch of sort of samples, and then you've got to come up with your own. Weird problem. So there's a nice survey of all these problems and showing reductions between them from Li Chen and Mike Cheng at Siren System. But I mean, you know. You'll notice there's no pairings directly in the statement of these problems, but these come up in pairing-based cryptography because you can sort of check the correctness of these things using pairings. So, you know, these things are like, turn out to be like signatures and things. Something like this is the idea of given you've seen a bunch of signatures and you've got to forge one on a message. So, and the signature is verified using a pairing. So these problems come up in pairing-based cryptography, even though there's not actually a pairing featuring in the description of the problem. Correct, yeah. Yes, that's correct. So there is a result about these things. There's a paper by John at Eurocrypt which tells you something interesting about these problems, and there's similar ideas developed by Dan Brown and Rob Gallant. And the Chon's theorem is if you've given XP and X to the DP, where D is a divisor of R plus or minus 1, then you can somehow slightly speed up your solving the discrete log by a factor of root D. It's kind of cool. And it'd be really nice if you could somehow... This is using the fact that you're somehow sort of a P minus 1 or P minus 1 P minus 1 or P plus 1 method, and the obvious thing you think, you should be able to put an elliptic curve here and get a more general case. But the problem is you don't actually have a Diffie-Hellman oracle, you just have sort of some lucky Diffie-Hellman values. So anyway, there's a nice paper if you want to read it. And it would be great if this could be generalized in some way. But what it tells you is that anything where you're given an input, a whole list of these things, you've got to be a little bit careful about, because somewhere in this list there might be an X to the D where D divides your point order plus or minus 1, and you might get some slight loss of security in that setting. So, I mean, what's the moral of all this? The moral of all this is there's loads of new computational problems pinging up in the crypto literature. These problems are not necessarily being looked at very much. If you look at them, even a quite simple result like this, you get a Eurocrypt paper. So, I mean, I strongly encourage people to work in this area. It's, Yeah, but I mean, this is attacking these problems. Another problem is something I've just been working on. There's something called the vector decomposition problem that's also sprung out of cryptography. And this is, so the statement of the problem is you've got a group which is not cyclic now. It's like there's the R torsion on an elliptic curve. And the problem is you're given points P1, P2, and Q, and P1 and P2 should be independent points that generate a full group. And you've got to somehow project into the two subgroups. So you've got to find an R so that R is in the subgroup generated by P1, and Q is the third point, minus R is in the subgroup generated by P2. So you're sort of projecting onto the basis. And this was proposed by Yoshida, and it was used for some crypto system, and then Dersmer has worked on this as well. And Yoshida has this proof that if you have these isomorphisms, and this is going to be a distortion map, and this is Frobenius. Then he shows that this should be harder than the Diffie-Hellman problem. And then I've just, in the last week or two, been proving a result that if you have these conditions, then, in fact, you're no harder than discrete log. And again, because of the Maurer reduction, these two problems should more or less be equivalent. So that's proving that this... So my result is that this vector decomposition problem is really nothing new. It's just discrete log. So to me, that's good news. Some cryptographers come up with some wacky new problem, and you show it's just one of the problems we already know. That one's gone. Let's kill the rest of them. That's the moral of the story. I can talk about this stuff. Great. Okay, now I put on my other hat, which is creating wacky problems and letting other people destroy them. This is something, an ANTS paper this year with Alex Dent. The idea is to publish a group description. Now, this is a very vague term. This is intentionally vague. So you should be able to publish some kind of description of a group, and people should be able to do a certain amount of stuff in that group. And then you should have some kind of private information. And that private information should allow you to compute a pairing on this group and then do things with it. For example, solve the decision Diffie-Hellman problem in that group. So the sort of the idea, and this other people have thought about this idea as well, is whether it's possible to do this. And in the ANTS paper, we give two proposals. One is sort of based on factoring. You give an elliptic curve mod n, where n is an RSA modulus. And the idea is you people can sort of compute on this curve. You use the normal elliptic curve formula and just work mod n instead of mod p, and it more or less works. And if you know the factorization, you know the group order, and then you can compute pairings. That was sort of the idea. That was proposal number one. And proposal number two was using something called a disguised elliptic curve. So this is where you... This is kind of a multivariate thing again. You take an elliptic curve equation over some extension field, like F2 to the M, and field elements, it's just like I was doing before, are M tuples over F2, and so you publish the group, the polynomials defining the group law. You sort of expand them out over this basis. So you expand them out into huge polynomials and huge numbers of variables, and then you perform some sort of private linear transformation, and you get an even more horrible system of polynomial equations, and you can publish these polynomial equations, and these are like a black box group. This is like something you plug in a whole bunch of bits, and out come a whole lot more bits, and this is sort of magically performing some group law, but you can't really see the natural representation of that group. So this was first proposed by, we say that Fry proposed this idea, and then if you look at Fry's paper, all he does is he says, he disguises the curve and says, can you count points on this curve? And he doesn't actually talk about computing in the group. So Fry was just proposing a disguised elliptic curve in the sense of, I've disguised it, and you can't do anything with it. Whereas we're saying we're disguising it, and we're giving you enough information that you can still maybe compute the group law or something. Anyway, but this idea starts with Fry. And then the security, as such, should depend on the ability to sort of solve these multivariate equations in some sense. So, yeah, what was I saying? I was saying people keep coming up with proposals, and they should be broken. So the challenge is to cryptanalyze both these two schemes. Well, don't bother with the last one. That's already done. So I've got a PhD student called Dave Morellis, and he's given a pretty comprehensive destruction of the second version, the multivariate sort of disguised curve version. But the finer points does depend slightly what's meant by group description. If his attack needs a full group law. So he really expects polynomial equations that will add an arbitrary 2 points and polynomial equations that will double an arbitrary point. But you can imagine giving people a bit less than that in their just group description. You could give them a doubling and then just addition by a fixed point P. And his attack doesn't seem to work in that case. But then you can do some other stuff as well. We talked about this a little bit in the ANTS paper. And you can imagine disguising other things to try and get black box groups. You could disguise tori and things. And I've got another PhD student working on that, and everything seems to fall over pretty happily as well. So I think it's safe to say that disguising things is a bad idea. Oh, I'm going to be early. So this is my final slide. So what I've tried to give you a flavor of is that there's a lot of computational problems coming out of cryptography, in particular pairing-based cryptography. These problems are not being well studied at the moment. I'm not at all convinced that some of these problems are hard. In fact, I'm fairly convinced some of them should be easy. And this workshop's called Computational Challenges in Cryptography and Number Theory. I encourage you to work on this stuff. So I'm around for the whole week. Yeah, we can talk about it. Okay, thanks very much.